The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, thank you guys for being here. Just to start, I want to say that the labor movement has looked bleak for a pretty long time now. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the number of major work stoppages in 2017 was the second lowest on record since they started keeping track in 1947. And the unionization rate, the percent of workers who are in unions, has been in steady decline for the last several decades. It's now less than half of what it was in the early 1980s. The recent ruling by the Supreme Court in favor of Janus will unfortunately drive these numbers down even further. And yet, in the midst of all of this, in the midst of extremely low levels of labor struggle, we witnessed this spring an awakening. Tens of thousands of teachers across the United States walked off the job en masse to demand funding for our schools, better wages, better health care, better working conditions, and respect on the job. And it was contagious. What started in one county in West Virginia quickly spread to the whole state. And from there to Oklahoma, to Arizona, to Kentucky, and Colorado, and North Carolina. Katie Endicott, a teacher from West Virginia, described this as the spark that became a flame. And they won. It was uneven from state to state, but they won. They won education funding. They won raises up to 20%. They won improvements to their health care, and they won respect. If not from their bosses, then from hundreds of thousands of people across the country who saw not only what teachers go through on a day-to-day basis, but what they were willing to do to stand up for themselves and for their students. These teachers reintroduced the strike as a weapon that can force the bosses to listen to us in a way that phone calls or letters to your congressman never could. They showed a glimpse of the power that the working class can have. In this talk today, we're going to try to answer a few questions. Why is this, what happened this spring, so important? Why haven't we seen anything like this in a long time? And why now? So to begin, I'm gonna spend the bulk of my time setting up an argument for what workers' power is and what that looks like. But before I get to that, I wanna take a step back and talk about what we mean when we say the working class. When politicians and the media refer to the working class today, they're usually referring to poor white people in the heartland who probably voted for Donald Trump. The working class is presented as some kind of forgotten identity rather than a position in relation to other classes in society. These mainstream misrepresentations have a real impact. When many people think about the working class, they think only of people who do manual labor in factories, mines, construction, etc., who are uneducated, who have little in the way of savings, and who are, in the public imagination, cis, male, straight, and white. It refers to a category of people who work, but do not earn enough money to be part of the upper class, decidedly non-elite, but better off than the poor or destitute. When Marxists talk about the working class, we're talking about something different. And to understand this, I want to talk for just a minute about how Marxists view history. Historical materialism is the framework for understanding history. We look at how society is organized and functions to reproduce itself. So how the basic and the not so basic necessities that are needed to keep society running, things like food and clothing and transportation, today also phones and computers, are created and distributed day to day. And how the system itself can be sustained generation to generation. These modes of production and distribution determine the social and political structures of that society. So capitalism is the most recent mode of production, but it hasn't always existed, and it was preceded by other forms of production, including feudalism, ancient slavery, and hunter-gatherer societies. What most of these forms of production have in common is that they each have a dominant exploiting class and an oppressed exploited class. So for example, under ancient slavery, the slave class produced directly for the slave masters. So slaves cultivated and prepared their masters' food, they built their homes, they made their clothes, and then they also used some small portion of what they produced for themselves. It was minimal, but it was enough to keep enough food, shelter, etc., to keep themselves alive and able to work the next day and reproduce the next generation of slaves. The vast majority of what slaves produced was exploited or extracted by the slave master who didn't labor at all. Under feudalism, the relations between serfs and lords looked different than under ancient slavery, but you still had serfs producing both what they needed to survive and a surplus, which is extracted by nobles in the form of rent, in either money or crops or other goods. So these two classes, the exploited and the exploiter, are always inherently in conflict. What's good for one is usually bad for the other. And I just wanted to bring up, I was just visiting some family in Maine, and I was flying out here, and I saw a local newspaper that had this headline that said, low employment is a double-edged sword. And what it actually meant was that low unemployment, in Maine there's pretty low unemployment right now, is bad for the bosses. But it's good for our side. And so what's good for our side is usually bad for theirs. We're usually in conflict. So the transition between different modes of production, from ancient slavery to feudalism or feudalism to capitalism, comes when that tension, the conflict between these classes, reaches a breaking point. And when technological advances have reached the possibility to organize production in a new way. Under capitalism, this relationship between the exploited and exploiting classes is slightly more hidden. As a worker, you don't directly produce the goods that you need to survive. You don't make your own food or your own clothes. But you're compensated for only a portion of what you produce. The difference, or surplus, between how much you produce and what you're actually compensated for is profit. And this is how the ruling class exploits the labor of the working class under capitalism. The basic dynamics of exploiter and exploited are still there. We have a ruling class which owns the means of production, the factories, the farms, the mines, etc., and then a working class who actually produces all the wealth in society. And so the ruling class is entirely dependent on the working class to provide for it. On the other hand, the working class has no need for the ruling class and would be better off without them. And for the first time in human history, this is possible. So socialism, a society where workers run things for themselves, is possible now because of the advances of capitalism, because we now produce more than enough for everyone to survive, and not just to survive, but to live comfortably. And socialism is possible because of the character of the working class. The working class is a class that has the power to emancipate itself. And its emancipation means an end to exploitation and profit, and an end to class society. So then who is the working class? The working class includes all those who actually produce the goods, and includes those who transport the goods for sale. So it includes factory workers, farm workers, tech workers, but also truck drivers, dock workers, and the people who pack and deliver Amazon orders. But the working class also includes those who are involved in social reproduction. You may have heard about that this weekend already. So this means that their work is not directly tied to production, but is necessary to keep the working class producing. So social reproduction includes bus drivers who get workers to their jobs every day. It includes road workers who keep the roads in good shape so that those buses can get workers to work every day. And teachers who both provide childcare so that parents can get to work and who teach kids the skill and work ethic necessary to become, quote, good workers when they're older. Of course, those of us who are socialist educators have a different vision for what education should look like. Social reproduction also includes domestic labor and unpaid labor in the home done disproportionately by women who do the cooking and the cleaning and the taking care of kids so that they and their partners can get to work the next day and to raise the next generation of workers. All of this is necessary for capitalism to continue day to day and generation to generation. This broader understanding of the working class, rooted in an analysis of how capitalism works, helps us see that the working class is both bigger and more diverse than most pundits would have us believe. Workers represent an absolute majority, more than 70% of the population of the United States, and are disproportionately women and people of color. And the working class is incredibly powerful. Or rather, it has immense potential. Workers don't feel powerful at work, and most don't have a lot of say around the conditions of their work. In fact, this is a defining feature of work for most people, not having control over the conditions of your work. But workers are at the heart of capitalism. Everything depends on the working class, which means that if we all decide to stop working, we can grind the entire system to a halt. Factory workers who go on strike can stop production. Bus drivers who go on strike can shut down an entire city because workers can't get to work. Dock workers who go on strike can stop whole shiploads of goods from being delivered to their destinations and can cost the ruling class millions of dollars. So workers are powerful when they realize their power. And this isn't just to say that workers need an attitude change. It's not about self-empowerment on a personal or individual level. If I alone decide I'm powerful, I'm gonna stop working, I'll get fired in a heartbeat. And I'll probably just make things worse for my coworkers. If I decide to walk out with a few of my friends, my boss would probably be able to replace us pretty quickly. On the other hand, when an entire factory or school or sector goes on strike, it can be devastating for profits. It can force the ruling class to take workers' demands seriously, and it can flip the dynamic about who's really in charge. And when people see that, and when they experience that themselves, there's nothing more liberating. The teachers who went on strike this past spring felt that for themselves. In an interview with socialist worker Noah Carvelis, who also spoke on the incredible panel last night, said this: "One of the beautiful things about this is how people have come together, and that attitude of intimidation is slowly disappearing. More and more people are feeling empowered by the solidarity, both across the state and nationwide." Another striking teacher in Oklahoma said, "This is my job now. I didn't know it was my job, but I'm an activist now." In West Virginia, teachers in the Capitol building chanted, "We are worthy." Nicole McCormick, a West Virginia teacher who spoke on the panel last night, said, "Because of the strike, I was able to take back my dignity." And this is what struggle can do. It makes ordinary people realize that they deserve more and that they have a say in what happens. So Will is going to talk in his part of the talk about where the current struggle comes from and why it's been so long since we've really had a fighting working class movement in this country. But I do want to say first that there's an incredibly vibrant history of militant working class struggle in America. I'm focusing on America because that's where we are, in the belly of the beast. But of course, there are relevant and important examples from across the world, and people should feel free to bring those up in the discussion. There could be and have been entire talks on any one of these examples. We don't have time today to give any sort of survey of the history of the working class struggle. But I do just want to give a few examples to give some idea of the history that has really been erased from public discourse. So we're currently in the city, in Chicago, where in 1886, hundreds of thousands of workers took to the street to demand an 8-hour day. Tens of thousands of workers participated in a general strike. Chicago was the epicenter of a national movement for an 8-hour day. In 1909, in New York City, garment workers, primarily young immigrant women, mostly Jewish, at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, walked off the job to protest long hours, dangerous work conditions, and low pay. The boss's response to their strike was to send in thugs to break up the picket lines, which resulted in a 13-week general strike that involved an estimated 20 to 30,000 garment workers, 75% of the city's garment workforce. In 1919 in Seattle, 65,000 workers not only struck, but took over the city for a period of 6 days in February. And I'll talk about this a little bit more at the end. By the 1930s, conditions were overripe for mass industrial unionism in the United States. Productivity was skyrocketing, which meant that fewer workers were producing more, and more jobs were becoming unskilled. The biggest union at the time was the AFL, and it was still organized by craft, which meant, for example, that the carpenters would be in one local, the painters in another, the printers in another, and so forth. But they were very dismissive of unskilled and semi-skilled workers. But there's growing militancy among those very workers. Thus came the formation of the CIO, originally as a wing of the AFL, but it quickly became a rival union federation. The CIO organized not according to craft, but according to industry, and welcomed unskilled and semi-skilled and skilled workers. Once they opened their doors, workers flooded in, and not just those who'd been barred from entry before, but also those in sectors who are already leading within their unions. What's more, the CIO made an explicit push to reach out to black workers who had previously been barred and discouraged from joining unions. This represented a new direction for class struggle in the United States. In 1936, 140,000 General Motors auto workers, 93% of GM's workforce, went on strike, either by walking off the job or by doing sit-down strikes. This struggle wasn't isolated. It was in the context of sit-down strikes in other industries across the country, but it was the most massive of these strikes. It was a rank-and-file uprising, which started in Flint, Michigan, against the wishes of union leaders, and which quickly spread to auto workers in cities throughout the Midwest. Workers in this strike took on not only the bosses at GM, but also the police, and even at times the CIO leadership. In the end, they managed not only to win their demands, but also to grow the ranks of the CIO and to push open the boundaries of what was possible. If people want to learn more about any of these struggles I just talked about or the history of working class struggle in this country, I highly recommend Sharon Smith's book, Subterranean Fire, which is available for sale in the book room. So I want to conclude my section with a few remarks about workers' power and organization. So I mentioned earlier, and I'm sure everyone here would agree, that workers' power is only possible when workers are organized. Unions play a very important role in the class struggle, both in securing and protecting a standard of living for working class people today, and in preparing our side for the struggle ahead. Of course, unions are not the only sorts of organizations that play these roles, but we focus on unions because they are the one place in society that both has a large subset of the working class involved in them, and that's still true today, even when union density is down, and because they're strategically located at the heart of production and profit. But there are also profound limitations to what unions are able to accomplish, even in the best of times. Unions are not revolutionary organizations. I'm sure everyone here knows that, but it's worth reminding. Unions don't have an aim of overthrowing capitalism or of abolishing exploitation. Every contract that's negotiated between a union and management is setting the terms of exploitation of the workers, not trying to get rid of exploitation altogether. Strikes and marches and workplace struggles can all help to push that agreement to be more favorable to workers, but it will never lead to an end to exploitation. So it's not a sellout when unions sign on to contracts that maintain a level of exploitation. That's the role that unions are designed to play. Exploitation and oppression are woven into the very fibers of capitalism. And strikes, while they're immense shows of power, are not enough on their own to permanently reverse that. We've seen time and again that any gains that are won through strikes and other militant actions are chipped away at once our side lets their guard down. The only way that we can get rid of exploitation and oppression for good is through revolution. And strikes give us a sort of preview of what that could look like. So I want to share one example. I said I'd come back to this. In Seattle, I mentioned there was a general strike of 65,000 workers in 1919. Workers took over the city and organized themselves to meet the needs of the strike and the needs of the people. So I want to share a quote that's in Subterranean Fire. The beginning of this quote is by the historian Jeremy Brucker, and then Sharon Smith adds onto it herself. So in Seattle, workers in the various trades organized themselves to provide essential services with the approval of subcommittees of the executive committee, which granted them exemptions from the strike. Garbage wagon drivers agreed to collect wet garbage that would create a health hazard, but not paper and ashes. Firemen agreed to stay on the job. The laundry drivers and laundry workers developed a plan to keep one shop open to handle hospital laundry. So they're doing the essential services that need to be done to keep themselves safe and to keep things running, but to still make the strike be effective. Sharon Smith continues, uniformed war veterans provided security for the city throughout the strike. The workers organized 21 dining halls around Seattle that served workers and their families more than 30,000 meals per day. There was no violence during the Seattle general strike, and arrests declined by half. This is just one example among hundreds that shows the ways that workers organize themselves when given the opportunity. Now, Seattle workers only held on to this power for 6 days because of pressure from union leaders. But they were inspired by the Russian Revolution, which had happened just 2 years before, where workers had seized power and had managed to hold on to it. One of the biggest factors that set Russia in 1917 apart from all other examples and that made the Russian Revolution successful, where so many other attempts have failed, was the presence of revolutionary organization. The Bolshevik Party provided direction and a vision of what was possible. But more importantly, the Bolsheviks were instrumental in emphasizing and expanding the power of workers' Soviets, which were not unlike the strike committees that we see elsewhere, but that were democratic, instantly recallable, and that took on, sometimes reluctantly, actual political power. And so when we talk about workers' organization, we often mean unions. But revolutionary socialist organization is a vital form of workers' organization. It's vital in the moments that matter, in the circumstances where workers actually have the opportunity to seize power. But revolutionary organization is also incredibly important in times like today, when revolution is not on the agenda and struggle is still at a relatively low level. It's important today because it provides a historical memory, It brings people together to study the past with an aim of preparing us for future struggles. It helps to link struggles together across state lines, like we saw in the plenary last night, and international lines, and between different movements. And it trains and strengthens our side for the fights that we face today and the fights to come. I'm going to hand it over now to Will.
All right, so in my part of the talk, I'm going to look back at the last wave of strikes in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. From those that built the public sector union movement and also the rank and file rebellion in the private sector. Then I'm going to sketch out an outline of the decades that followed of backlash by the bosses, known as the neoliberal era, that turned the tide against the working class and fundamentally reshaped the terrain between capital and labor. And lastly, I'm going to wrap up by discussing what the prospects and challenges are for a labor upsurge and militant activity are now in the light of the Red State Educators' Rebellions. So in addition to the immense social struggles and the rise of the new left that characterized the 1960s and 1970s, the period also witnessed one of the major waves of labor militancy in U.S. history. This wave of militant workplace action holds a lot of important lessons for labor militants and socialists today who are trying to understand the current moment with the goals of revitalizing our unions and reconnecting the working class with the revolutionary socialist politics. Caitlin talked about some of the strikes that built the industrial unions of the CIO in the 1930s. So coming out of these struggles and others that followed, a framework for collective bargaining and the legal right to strike were developed. However, public sector unions were largely left out of this framework. Public sector strikes remained illegal in all states up until the 1960s, when the late 1960s, when Vermont loosened restrictions on public employee strikes, and until 1970, when Hawaii was the first state to legalize them. In many states, they actually remain illegal up to this day, including in the some Democratic strongholds, such as New York, where unions and workers can be heavily penalized under the draconian Taylor Law. Unsurprisingly, in this post-war period, wages in the public sector began to lag significantly behind unionized private sector workers. So at the same time, according to Joel Burns in his book, Strike Back, the period between 1946 and 1967 saw a significant expansion in governments that provided services that produced an increase in public sector employment from 5.5 million to 11.6 million workers. So layers of these new public workers could look at their peers and unions in the private sector who were able to improve their wages and working conditions through strike activity and wonder to themselves, why can't I have some of that? Indeed, it was through an inspiring movement of rank and file workers willing to defy the law and employ the strike weapon, sometimes with only minorities of their co-workers initially taking part, that forced recalcitrant city, state, and federal government bodies to concede to their demands. It was through this process of flaunting the law to build strikes, or at least the threat of one, that these unions were ultimately built. So before we get into this into some of the history and some of the examples, it's worth taking a moment to get into to talk about the differences between public and private sector strikes. So while the aim of a private sector strike is to hit the bosses and the profits where it hurts the most, the state might actually save money during a strike of public sector workers. In order to win, public sector strikes have to put pressure on political officials. This means that public sector strikes have an inherently political nature, one which requires workers to develop relationships with and build support and solidarity with the broader community in order to win. This is also why, in some conditions, public sector strikes may win with only a minority of workers participating, whereas in the private sector, more often than not, this would be a recipe for disaster. Given their inherently political nature, while public sector unionism has its own dynamics, just as any social movement does, the rise and fall are often intricately connected to the strength of other social movements. The interplay here is most evident in the strikes in the South that had major participation from the civil rights movement. And the most salient example here was the Memphis sanitation workers' strike that Martin Luther King Jr. participated in during the last year of his life. And Ronnie just as an aside, Ronnie Flores gave a talk about this earlier today that Carmets can listen to on We Are Many later. So this connection, though, with social movements at the time, particularly to the civil rights movement, was also shared more broadly, though not ubiquitously, by the early public sector labor union movement. So with this correlation of public sector unionism with other social movements actually holds up internationally as well. And just to give one example, the rise of the public sector union movement in Brazil was also tied to the fight against the dictatorship in the 1980s there. And we could go to other examples internationally. But just to come back to our context in the United States, to give one more important example, in the 1950s, the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, the union that I'm a part of, actually expelled all of their southern locals for their refusal to integrate. And this actually cost them about 8,000 teachers and educator members. In New York City, the local of the AFT that was to become the United Federation of Teachers was led by a small group of educators who spent the entire decade of the 1950s trying to build up for a strike. The Teachers Guild, as they were called at the time, has a problematic legacy that we need to point out before we get into this. So they collaborated with the government on attacks on leftist teachers during the Red Scare. And for those who aren't aware, that period of the Red Scare actually severed the link between socialists and the labor movement that was really intricate during all the time that Caitlin was talking about. But the Teachers Guild, despite this, they understood the need to engage in militant action around demands that were widely shared by educators. So finally, in 1960, they were able to carry out their first strike, timed for maximum effect to be the day before Election Day, which they pulled off with only 5,600 teachers, which was about 16% of teachers in the city. Still, this forced the city to hold elections to establish them as the exclusive agent for collective bargaining. So after winning this election, this set the model for other public sector unions across the country. So subsequent victorious UFT strikes in 1962, saw about half of the teachers in the city participate. And in 1967, about 80% of teachers took part. Not only did these strikes change the terrain of the labor movement in New York City, but they sparked a wave of educator strikes across the United States. Unfortunately, the UFT's connection to the emerging Black Power movement soon frayed, and the UFT found itself on the wrong side of efforts by activists in the predominantly Black neighborhood of Ocean Hill-Brownsville in New York City, who were sick of failed attempts by the city and the union to integrate the schools. So they initiated an attempt to assert community control over their local schools. What the UFT did was they actually called a series of strikes against the community control board's attempt to transfer a group of white teachers out of the district, with the community control board claiming that these white teachers weren't able to properly meet the needs of the children of color in the neighborhood. So the UFT ultimately actually won these series of strikes on very narrow grounds, and the experiments in community control ended. But the damage done with the union's prestige and the growing communities of color in the city was done. So by the time the UFT went on strike again in 1975, they had substantially alienated themselves from the Black and Puerto Rican communities that they taught in, which is one of the reasons that that strike was lost. 1975 was the last time the UFT would go on strike. Even with the subsequent decline of social movements and the fraying of the union's movements, the union's connections to them, public sector workers across the country learned that strikes work. Teachers continued to play a leading role in this period, where between 1974 and 1980, they accounted for nearly 44% of all work stoppages of government employees. Of course, while teachers were the tip of the spear in the public sector strike wave, they were not the only workers to rebel. This period saw successful strike activity that led to the establishment of collective bargaining rights for social workers, air traffic control workers, firefighters, and postal workers, who in 1970 launched the largest public sector strike in US history, a wildcat strike carried out by the membership without the approval of the union leadership. So meanwhile, the strike wave during this period wasn't just confined to the private sector. I won't be able to do any justice to this during the talk, but a decline in wages in the late 1960s, management imposition of speed-ups, and a stultifying union bureaucracy all contributed to a rank-and-file rebellion in the private sector that was often heavily influenced by the anti-war and Black Power movements, and often in opposition to union leadership. One inspiring example was DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, which spawned spin-offs among Black workers and auto plants across the country and sparked several wildcat strikes. There's a really great book about it called Finally Got the News that Carmets should check out from the book room. Actually, that's a documentary that you should check out. It's on YouTube. The book is called The Choice I Do Mind Dying, which you should watch it and read it. Yeah. Wildcatting was another characterization of the strike wave, as workers went out of the factories without the blessing of their union leaders. So this period also saw the development of rank-and-file-led union reform caucuses, which did see some mixed successes, one of which is the Teamsters for Democratic Union, which survives today. So sadly, this rank-and-file rebellion was not to last. The period also saw the overall rate of profit for companies decline, and economic recessions in 1974 to 1975, and then again in 1980 to 1982. The US ruling class responded by preparing an offensive on the unions and the living standards of workers through the launch and revitalization of organizations such as the Business Roundtable, the US Chamber of Commerce, and the National Association of Manufacturers, increasingly allied with Democratic Party politicians in the Carter administration. This would not only see the end of the last wave of worker militancy of strikes, but bring in decades of decline in working class militancy, organization, and living standards. The period brought in by this project was known as neoliberalism, which David Harvey has succinctly described as a project to restore class power to the economic elite. So workers didn't take the sitting down. So for example, when US President Jimmy Carter invoked the anti-union Taft-Hartley Act to send the United Mine Workers back into the mines during the bituminous coal strike of 1977 and 78, the workers were able to ignore the president's order with impunity. West Virginia coined the appropriate response by saying, "Taft can mine it, Hartley can haul it, and Carter can shove it." However, while these workers showed their ability to flaunt regressive federal labor laws, they ultimately went back to work under a concessionary contract, a pattern that would grow increasingly familiar in the new era. Writing about the 1980 and 1982 recession, in his book On New Terrain, which is this one here, Kim Moody wrote that in the 3 years or so of the recession, 2.5 million manufacturing jobs were lost. The unions that had been the major sites of the 1960s and 70s rebellion lost more than 2 million members. Well, the number of all private sector union members dropped by 26%, and strikes all but disappeared. So this assault on labor would only intensify when the Republican president, Ronald Reagan, was elected into office, who famously fired over 11,000 Patco air traffic control workers out on strike, signaling the go-ahead to corporations that they had a free hand from the government in their union busting. In the popular consciousness, this marks the end of the previous era, particularly since Patco had a particularly militant history of taking workplace and strike action. During the same period I was talking about of public sector unionization. In all, during the period of neoliberalism, union density declined from a total of 19.5% in 1980, 15.5% in 1990, 12.8% in 2000, to 10.7% last year in 2010. Broken down by sector, last year union density in the public sector was 34.4%, while in the private sector it was a dismal 6.5%. And we can expect the relatively higher numbers in the public sector to take a hit after the recent Janus ruling, the Supreme Court ruling for public sector workers that allowed public sector workers to opt out of paying their union dues. So another aspect of neoliberalism that has been an unrelenting attack on public services. Moody, discussing the effects of neoliberalism and the recent effects on the workplace today, wrote, and this is a long quote, but I think it's reciting in full, "The federal government cut 285,124 jobs between 1990 and 2010, 173,000 and odd, or 60%, from the U.S. Postal Service, which also faces the threat of privatization. This hit workers of color, who composed over half the mail sorting and processing staff the hardest. From 2009 to the late 2015, state governments lost 68,000 jobs, while local governments cut 418,000. Particularly hard hit were teachers, as states cut school aid to cities, which on average accounts for almost about 46% of local school budgets. While between 2008 and 2015, the number of students rose by 804,000, the number of teachers fell by 297,000, with women accounting for the majority of these workers. So while the neoliberal period has seen a major restructuring of the working class, most notoriously a decline in the overall number of manufacturing workers, it is not simply the case that workers have been made too fragmented and marginal to be relevant anymore, let alone a force that no longer has the power to shut things down and remake society. So contrary to what one might expect, manufacturing has not declined in terms of output or profitability. In fact, the opposite is true. What has declined significantly is the total number of workers employed in manufacturing. While this is often explained as the result of imports and outsourcing, this is actually only a small part of the picture. For example, most of the outsourcing that occurred, thank you. Most of the outsourcing that occurred, so I've got the font on this way too small. I thought I was like trying to make it bigger before so it'd be easier to read, and I don't think I did it quite enough. Okay. In the traditional industrial heartland of the Midwest, let me start that over. So while this is often explained as the result of imports and outsourcing, this is actually only a small part of the picture. For example, most of the outsourcing has occurred in the traditional heartland of the Midwest and moving to non-union states in the US South. Those workers are more often than not still there. They're just working in more precarious positions for lower wages and benefits without unions. A significant chunk of the downsizing in the industrial labor force has actually been accomplished through layoffs during the recessions. Then making those workers remaining pick up the slack for their former co-workers. It's through the intensification of the work through lean production and other means that capital has been able to achieve dramatic productivity gains and increases in profits on our backs during the neoliberal era. This importation of lean production methodologies that are intended to boost production by working employees harder was yet another major innovation of the neoliberal era. Moody describes lean production succinctly by saying that it is shorthand for the multitude of programs induced over time in this long period to impose measurable and standardized work processes or metrics and further reduce labor input in relation to output. Mike Parker and Jane Slaughter at Labor Notes have dubbed it management by stress. Initially contained within the auto industry, the practice gradually spread throughout manufacturing and into the service industry and care professions like nursing and teaching. Any teacher who's ever been rated by a principal on their students' test results should be familiar with this. So this year, one striking teacher in Oklahoma recounted her experience on lean production in her own words by saying, "It's like when the Pharaoh said to the overseers that you are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota." All of this has led to an overall deterioration of working conditions and living standards in this country. And with a skyrocketing level of inequality, and a stat that Jillian used on the fantastic panel last night, three men own the same wealth as the bottom 50% in US society. And locating the source of this inequality, Moody quotes the Marxist economist Anwar Sheikh, stating that the overall degree of income inequality ultimately rests on the ratio of profits to wages, that is on the basic division of value added. So this year saw the long-awaited explosion of working class struggle in the form of educator strikes in red states like West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona. These strikes are not without their predecessors. From the 1997 UPS strike to the 2012 teacher strike here in Chicago, just to cite two outstanding examples. What makes these red state educator rebellions stand out among these other inspiring strikes was the fact that they generalized and spread from one place to another and the way that these others failed to. So does this mean that we're at the start of a new upsurge in labor militancy? So before we get into this question, which by the way I actually don't have an answer to, we should ask why, of all possible sectors, did this strike wave erupt among educators? With a much smaller but nonetheless significant uptick in strike activity among healthcare workers, as well for example, strikes at Tufts Medical Center in 2017 and Bay State Medical Center in 2018, plus a potential upcoming strike at the University of Vermont Medical Center in a couple days, one could expand this question to why so much is happening among care workers generally. So I think one reason is the de-skilling of workers in education and healthcare, and the introduction of lean production techniques that I discussed earlier. The aforementioned attacks on the public sector and the bipartisan corporate ed reform movement are other factors. Each of these have had huge impacts on both the quality of working conditions for teachers and the quality of education available to working class families. Further, education and healthcare workers have become one of the main lines for handling the social crises created by the systemic inequality and racism in this country. As Emily Comer said in the Solidarity panel in New York City, and Jillian beat me to the punch by quoting this last night in her panel, but it's such a great quote that I'm gonna give it back to you. As teachers, we have a unique window into the entire economy of our communities. We, every day, we see the effects of the opioid crisis and poverty at every level. All that plays out in the classroom. So it's not just about my paycheck, it's not just about my health care. The worse the economy gets, the harder my job gets. Thanks. To put just a few numbers on only one aspect of this, there are 8,000 homeless students in West Virginia. In New York City, where I teach, 10% of public school students were homeless in 2016, and that's a total of about 111,000 students. So this underscores the need for our movements to make connections with the communities we work within, and that our actions to defend our livelihoods as teachers and public workers are bound up with the defense of deeply needed public services. A great example of how a teacher strike was able to make these links concrete was in the 2012 teachers strike here in Chicago, which took the slogan, "Our working conditions are our students' learning conditions." In advance of that strike, they published a pamphlet called "The Schools Our Chicago Students Deserve," which, among other things, called out the educational apartheid in the segregated and underfunded schools in low-income communities of color. So while these are some of the conditions facing care workers generally across the country, what were some of the more specific factors that led to these strikes happening in red states? For starters, in each of these states, teacher salaries were basically in a competition for whose could be the lowest in the country, where teachers often had to take multiple jobs to make ends meet. Couple that with attacks by conservative state legislatures on healthcare benefits and pensions of public city workers, and these workers didn't feel like they had that much to lose. These strike actions were also bound up with the defense of their students' right to a quality education, with each of these states also vying for the bottom spot in per pupil funding. Whether or not this educators' rebellion will continue in the red states and spread to the blue states in the coming years remains to be seen. And while there are real objective obstacles to its continuance, to its continued spread, that we as a movement will need to contend with, the conditions for it are very much present. So for one, the upcoming midterm elections will present a real pull on workers to channel their militancy into the electoral arena. While this is particularly seductive when public sector workers have the ability to elect their own bosses. While elections shouldn't be completely discounted as a way to further the cause of workers, they do represent a real potential danger to the movement and ultimately won't be a substitute for exerting workers' power in the workplace. Another factor are the teacher shortages in these red states that contributed to the confidence of educators to risk their jobs by going out on strike, knowing that they had the fallback option to cross state lines for a significant pay hike. While this shortage of teachers may not be as acute in other parts of the country, it is still broadly present. Further, this trend is currently true throughout the entire economy, with recent reports showing that for the first time in decades, there are more job openings than people currently classified as unemployed. While this alone doesn't determine whether there will be a labor upsurge, it does create the potential for an increase in worker confidence. Okay. So one of the common arguments against militant action often made by labor leaders in blue states is that we have it too good and we have too much to lose. For example, in New York City where I teach, teachers are the highest paid in the country, but when you factor in the high cost of living, that number is actually brought down to about the 17th. Also, public sector workers in West Virginia have been staving off massive attacks on the Public Employee Insurance Agency. And meanwhile, public workers in New York and across the country are facing huge cuts to our healthcare benefits in the face of a massive crisis in affordability and accessibility to healthcare. So these challenges in blue states are even more formidable than that, though. In places like New York City, we face deeply entrenched union bureaucracy that are experienced and skilled at tamping down on rank-and-file opposition and resistance. Not only that, but they have a deeply rooted dependence on Democratic Party politicians that is only likely to deepen after Janus. For instance, one strategy the UFT is taking now is to pass a credit for city union members on our city income taxes that would equal the cost of dues. This may sound progressive or pro-union, but it would be a cudgel that politicians could hold over our heads in any future negotiations. And that this dependence reached embarrassing levels with the recent endorsement of Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo by the UFT, despite the fact that Cuomo has publicly stated that the public school system is the last remaining monopoly and that we will work to bust up. Further, the movement will need to reckon with the real effects of the anti-union Supreme Court decisions like Janus, and there are others to come, which have the real potential to weaken our forces. So I know I'm going a little bit over time, but I'll start wrapping up. So there are conditions in the private sector that may create the conditions for labor upsurge there as well. It is well known now by many labor activists that increasingly complex logistic chains and just-in-time practices make industries potentially vulnerable to strikes, though this reality is still largely within the realm of potential. Importantly, the new logistics hubs are predominantly located in large urban areas whose workers correspond to the demographics of the working class that Caitlin described in her section of the talk, which I think is important for any organizing efforts. Another factor that puts more potential power in the hands of workers is the increasing concentration of capital in fixed assets such as buildings, machines, technology, and other infrastructure. So according to Kim Moody, from 1992 to 2012, the real net private stock of fixed assets per production and non-supervisory worker rose from $1,432,000 to $2,380,000, or by 66.3%. In manufacturing, it rose from $98,000 to $247,000, or 151% over these years. Compare those numbers with an average lifetime wage of a worker with a bachelor's degree at $1.8 million, and take note that the value of capital that lies within your hands at your work is likely worth more to the bosses than the value of your life. So, as Moody quoted Anwar Sheikh arguing with regards to this, capital-intensive industries will also tend to have high levels of fixed costs, which will make them more susceptible to the effects of slowdowns and strikes. At the same time, because labor costs are likely to be a smaller portion of their total costs, such industries are more able to tolerate wage increases. So excitingly, with more than 250,000 Teamsters at UPS recently voted over 90% to authorize a strike. Well, it seems that their leadership has absolutely no intention of going out. In this context, just the threat of it leads us to imagine and wonder how much these workers would actually be able to transform the entire political landscape through a well-orchestrated strike. To wrap up, while we can't predict exactly when and where the future labor upsurges will happen, we can be sure they will occur. So Moody quoted the Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm, describing the sort of conditions that lead to what he calls leaps or explosions of strike activity and union growth as accumulations of inflammable materials which only ignite periodically, as if it were under compression. There are a number of key lessons for us to draw out from the strike wave and the Red State Rebellion. One, that the working class still matters and has the power to shut shit down and win. Two, with all the letter writing, lobbying, backroom dealing, and electioneering that have been the dominant strategies of the movement for decades, it took militant workplace activity and striking to actually start making gains. Three, that strong rank-and-file organization is capable of forcing a weak and ineffective union leadership to follow their lead. Four, that these education workers showed that when we are united and win the support of the community that we are working within, we have the power to break the law with impunity. And lastly, five, that small groups of conscious workers, often referred to as the militant minority, under the right conditions, have the potential to make a real difference in terms of crystallizing rank and file organization and lead up to the strike, to a strike, and seeing it through once it begins. So as Kim Moody summarized the tasks of socialists and labor militants in the current movement, in the current moment, what is needed now is not crystal ball gazing, but preparation. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.